So for those of you who are new to this or just joining us, my name is Rita McGrath. My day job is as a professor at Columbia Business School. And I am thrilled to have as today's guests, Rob Cross and Karen Dillon. Rob's with Babson. Karen was formerly with HBR and now has this incredible entrepreneur career that she's running. And they've both just come up with this great book, The Micro-Stress Effect. You can see all the little threading that I've run in it. And what I love about this book is it talks about not just like the one big thing, right, that affects us, but the thousands of little things that can actually add up to a great big thing. And I love early in the book, you say, you know, every week becomes that one week. So maybe start off with what inspired you. And I guess, Rob, this started with you. What inspired you to write the book and where it kind of came from, where this idea came from?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So like you, you know, my day job is professor and the rest of my world is running a consortium called the Connected Commons. And so that's a group that's grown to about 150 organizations that really has sponsored a range of different kinds of work into looking at networks and collaboration analytically and then seeing what's the impact, right, on individuals, teams, organizations, things like that. And we have been engaged in this program of work for over a decade where we were running all these analytics and organizations, getting separate performance data and seeing high performers and what they were doing, right? And that led to a lot of insights that the companies were using to create enterprise leader programs, other things like that. But I was really lucky 5 or 6 years ago, you know, we're presenting some of those results at one of the major conferences we hold each year. And the members started pushing back and saying, you know, we love your work, right, on performance. We'd also like to think about success as also kind of thriving in your work or just broader well-being, career satisfaction, life satisfaction. And I kind of chuckle about it now because at the time I just groaned. I didn't want to do it. And I just, because everybody
talk about micro-stress.
Everybody was talking about innovation and revenue production and growth. But you know, we took it on and then it evolved into looking at, you know, how the connections, broadly speaking, in our worlds affect our well-being, right? Because there's a tremendous amount of evidence saying that we're losing the quality of our connections. You know, if we drift into clinical categories of loneliness, you know, that's the equivalent mortality rate of smoking 15 cigarettes a day. I mean, just all this evidence that's showing that things aren't going well, but people aren't really paying attention to it outside of saying we need two best friends, you know? And so what we really honed in on was this study designed to see what are the ways that connections in our lives have an impact positively on our well-being. And then to be honest, again, we kind of stumbled into the micro-stress idea in the very first interview. You know, we ended up doing hundreds of interviews for this book. And it really came out of the very first interview that what we saw was it wasn't the big stress that was literally killing this woman. It was the accumulation of small. And so we kept digging on that over time. And it really infected our souls, to be honest with you. You get into hundreds of interviews with people at this level, and it just changes your life a little bit. You start to see things very, very differently. So that's a little bit of an evolution of how it started.
Well, and I think one of the most interesting things about the book to me is that you've really been able to break it down into very specific forms of micro-stress. And in fact, you've got 14 of them. And I thought it was very interesting that you break them into these three categories, right? So you've got capacity draining. So things that just make you feel like at the end of the day, all you want to do is like, as my friend Maura at Aaron's Mila says, you know, knock back a vodka and put on Netflix and like just be done. So capacity draining, emotion depleting, and identity challenging. And I thought it was interesting that you came up with those categories. And Karen, I'd love you to kind of weigh in on how you got involved with this project.
Sure. So as you know, I worked on a book with Clay Christensen called How Will You Measure Your Life? And that caused me to make very different choices in my own life to try to do work that had meaning for me and to put my resource allocation in my family and things like that. And Rob happened to be a fan of How Will You Measure Your Life? And so early on, he reached out to me to just basically see if there was a connection. And in spite of not wanting to take on extra projects and sort of realizing my own micro-stress level was much higher than it should be, I actually thought this was a really important kind of follow-up to How Will You Measure Your Life? The idea of how will you measure life is how do you make sure that you're creating a strategy for your life that gets you to where you want to be so your life has meaning at the end and you'll measure it as success. But that's sort of nice to say, but maybe sometimes hard to execute. And so as Rob started sharing his early findings in the research, I was just sucked in because it felt so important. This was the how am I going to do that? How am I going to find time? Yes, I want to have a life of meaning, but I'm kind of overwhelmed getting through the day. So Rob and I met a couple times to talk about the work.
She's telling it like she was sold immediately. It took me three coffees, 3 trips into the city.
In hindsight, I caused him micro stress in even having this process because I made him come to a coffee shop within walking distance of my house so it would not take any extra time. Now I know he's the busiest man in the world, and it was really, he went out of his way to do it. But it felt really important to me, and it felt like I related to this personally. I need this book personally, and I thought a lot of other people could too. And Rob's research was really fascinating.
It is super fascinating. And I think it's very timely, obviously, because we're in the middle of this huge sort of quandary about what is work, where is work a thing, is work a place? And a lot of what you talk about is the micro stresses of what happens in a typical workplace. You know, somebody lets you down on a project and that ricochets into other areas and now you're catching up and you miss the kids' ball game. And it's this sort of hairball of stuff that we all experience. And yet finding our ways to dig out of that is really hard. What I know you're interested in talking about here is this notion of resilience and perhaps some of the solutions. So just to kind of wrap the book in a nutshell, Exhibit A right here, I've got it right there. But the book really talks about these 14 sources of just things that you feel are out of your control and things like unpredictable authority figures. So your boss comes in and, you know, changes the agenda for the week, and that happens every week. And it's like, oh, geez, now I've got to go change what I'm doing with my people. And that's sort of bouncing off each other kind of that happens a lot at work. So maybe talk a little bit. I should also mention you've got an app, right? Which is, it's on the App Store.
Yes, I definitely urge people to take a look at it. We set it up. It's obviously for free and just gives people a neat chance to go in and diagnose and get, you know, prompts to remember to take action over time and things like that. So I would urge people to take advantage of that.
Absolutely. There. And I think part of the dilemma with like mustering the energy to deal with these micro stresses, because mustering the energy to do something different requires energy. So if you're already sort of depleted, it's really hard to do that. But it reminds me of a lot of these things, like losing weight or sticking to an exercise regime or whatnot. It's not like you're once and done, right? It's a daily thing that you have to deal with.
Right.
So maybe talk a little bit about this notion of how you build resilience into what you do so that you're not completely flat every time one of these things hits you.
Yeah. And if I can, maybe I'll take that in two steps, if I could, just to talk a little bit about also how people are making the ideas actionable. So that's, you know, very important to us as the way we have 14 of them makes it actionable, but trying to write a book on 14, a list of 14, makes it boring. And so there's this constant, you know, interplay between how do you get the stories and the richness in it and small tools at different points, but then, you know, aggregate what people can do. I think one of the things I would anchor on is our chapter 5, where we're really saying, here's 14 of these micro stresses. And then across the top of this grid, we're saying, here's the sources that typically create them, right? The boss, you know, authority figures, like you mentioned, colleagues letting you down, children and stressing you out, aging parents. I mean, really thinking kind of more comprehensively. And when we look at it that way and we're working with groups, what we see is we'll take people, you know, through that grid 3 times. You know, the first time we'll say, where are 2 or 3 of these that are systemic enough in your life that you should be doing something about it, right? You should be changing the nature of an interaction, creating more space between them, putting those interactions in other groups, all sorts of opportunities to shift that. And inevitably, to your point, people start filling this grid out in leadership programs and they start getting to 10 or 12. And you're like, no. If it's everything, it's nothing, right? You've got to focus in on 2 or 3 that you can legitimately take action on. But what we know, and you would know this too from your work, is that the impact of removing the negative on our well-being is much greater than introducing a positive, right? So, you know, typically 3 to 5 times the impact of the negatives in our lives, social psychology shows, versus the positives. And so it's really worth doing. We don't do it that much. You know, I'm finding it's actually hard to get people to think about it. You know, they're quick to jump to what they should go do. They're a little bit more harder to kind of think about how do we take some of these interactions down around us. So what we see is, you know, kind of isolating 3 to 4, you know, that you can take action on now has no material impact. Then we have them go through this grid a second time and say, what are 3 or 4 that you're causing others? Right. And this always catches people off guard, you know, because, oh, I'm not, you know, causing it. And then they start thinking about it. I'm like, well, you know, maybe I am leaning on my child too heavily in a certain way, or maybe this one employee that I keep going back to. And the reason that is what we can see culturally in places when we map these, we do large podcasts or webinars or things like that. And people are polling against, here's the stresses I'm experiencing, here's the stresses I'm causing, is that the profiles are almost identical, right? So the stresses these leaders are absorbing, they tend to pass on without really thinking about it. And so you want to stop that, obviously. But from an individual standpoint, what we know is that the stress we create tends to boomerang back on us in different forms, right? So you lean on that employee too heavily, they start to disengage, burn out, you're working harder, you know, you're not getting their innovative insights. And many, many ways, you know, we see evidence of that. So the second pass through is kind of, how do you stop it? And then the third pass, and maybe I'll hand this one to Karen a little bit to talk about, is to kind of back away and say, where are you kind of down in the minutia too much? Right? Where do you have three or four points where you've just let something get under your skin and you've made a mountain out of a molehill? And in the perspective of life, you really should be kind of backing away from that. And that was one of the cool things, right, that we found the 10 percenters or our top happy people did a lot more effectively than the rest of us. So,
well, let me just, and I'll get back to you, Karen, in just a sec. But one of the things that really intrigued me was so much of the solution is actually outside work. Like, a lot of the micro stresses are related to work, but a lot of the solutions are kind of outside it. So, Karen, go ahead.
No, that actually segues perfectly into explaining a little bit more about this third pass of identifying two or three things that you're just going to choose to rise above, not because you're Pollyanna, not because, you know, you're just trying to forget the negative. It's because you realize these things are systemic enough, and in the grand scheme of things, they're actually not really going to matter that much. But one of the ways that we found was really effective for doing this is that Rob mentioned the people in our research, a subset, a small subset that we started calling the 10 percenters, because they represented roughly 10% of the people in our interviews who actually were just better at rising above. They didn't let microstress derail them in the same way that many other people did, is because they actually put some time and energy into building what we call a multidimensional life. They actually had connections with two or three authentic connections with groups or activities involving other people outside of work and home, which actually just did all kinds of things for them, including helping keep everything in perspective, seeing things differently, putting them in contact with people who have, you know, maybe a whole different set of problems that make yours seem not so bad. Building a multidimensional life, again, and not in giant, huge change your life ways, but in small ways, small moments of connection, was a really powerful antidote to kind of not letting the microstress that we all have completely drag you under. And so we learned from our 10 percenters that finding small ways to do that in your everyday life has a really big difference, makes a really big difference in your ability to navigate all this.
That's great. So so we have these specific micro stresses. Are there, like, what are some of the, so you pick a couple to work on, right? So I'll just pick one at random. Lack of trust.
Lack of trust. So we could grab that one, or even just you really laid it out great in terms of the changes from an authority figure, right? Yeah. You know, we're used to that hitting us directly and you go, oh, that really stinks. It usually takes the form of changing the what of the work, changing the expectations, the performance that's being asked, or emotionally showing up different from point A to point B. And people are used to that. What we often miss in this game is it's not just the immediate impact that hits us, but it's also the fact that, like you said, you have to go then and probably satisfy commitments you made to other people to go on a certain trajectory of work where you needed their help, and you need to go get new friends, right, to adjust to the pivot in different ways. And so, or you may be protecting your team, right, and buffering the team in different ways. And so there is a real strong kind of effect of these things. And the crazy thing for us is, you know, all of this kind of sits beneath our awareness, right? All these things are small. They don't get to the fight or flight response mechanism that real stress, like big stress, a health scare or something like that, causes us. So our brains aren't really registering. And for successful people, these are all just things you get over, right? You just deal with each of them, right? And work through it. But our bodies are absorbing it, right? In the way that big stress hits us. And so that's why, you know, a lot of us end the day each day and we're exhausted. We can't quite put a finger on what just happened, you know, anymore. And it has, you know, impacts on us neurologically, even metabolically. You know, Karen was really great in finding a lot of the research on this. And one study showed that if we consume a meal, you know, within 2 hours of being under this form of social stress at a certain level, we metabolize that meal at 104 greater calories. And so you do that over the course of a year, and that is equates to 11 pounds or something like that.
Wow.
And it's a product of the same meal, right? Just a product of, you know, kind of the stress that enacts. So there's all these little examples of it, you know, and we could go into any one of them in a little bit more depth. And they're very tactical things you can do on each. But what we know is it's pretty critical to be paying attention to how you drive this down, you know, more systematically in your life today.
Well, one of our listeners is asking, can you repeat the name of the app?
It's called the Micro Stress Effect app. Yeah.
It looks like the cover of the book. You'll know you have the right one.
It looks just like it. Yeah.
All right, I'll put that in the chat so
whoever
can have it there. So go ahead, Karen.
I just wanted to add to understanding the example of the boss is a really good one. Microstress, in our definition, is not caused by toxic, evil people. They're not complete jerks. They're caused by people who are just close to us in our personal and professional lives, people who we're around and care about, or maybe have emotions about. But it's not people. It's not, you know, ill will that's causing this. It's not a really jerky boss. It's just the fact that we're all so busy. We're all so interconnected. We shift who we work with all the time, the ways that we work with. So microstress happens in the interactions. It's not the person, it's the interaction that we have with the person. And so it's baked into our everyday lives. So we sort of don't even realize it's happening. It happens so quickly. And every individual microstress seems like I can manage that. My boss has a new priority this week. I'll figure it out. But as you say, it'll happen. It'll be this week and then next week and then the next week. And your boss is well-intentioned. They may not realize, or hopefully they are, may not realize the microstress they're causing you, but it has all kinds of ripple effects, not only on your day, but on your colleague's day, and then you bring it home at night. So the point is, it's people that you can't get away from. It's part of your everyday life, and it's the interactions that cause the micro stress, not the relationship itself.
I thought that was so interesting, and also the idea that well, first of all, you can avoid it, right? If you're dealing with human beings, unless you're in a cave somewhere, you know, you're dealing with other people, and other people are going to be unpredictable and emotional and respond to things in a way that you didn't expect and, right? But I think the idea that you can actually make these things visible, to me, that's where you have to start. Because I was reading the book, I was like, oh, yeah, like yeah, that happens to me too.
Right.
Get some off the wall email. And I will confess, you know, we all have coping mechanisms that aren't really coping. They're not really helping solve the problem, right? So like I'll get an email I don't want to deal with and I'll just leave it there, right? Skip to the next thing, but it's still there. Making it get better by putting it off, right.
It's funny. So one of my stories in this is I have a daughter that was a very high-end tennis player, you know, going through the juniors and her circuit. And I knew nothing about tennis, but I would chase her around the country and do everything I could to support what she was up to. And what that created over time was a dynamic where she relied on me as a source of resilience, right? When things were not going well for her at anything, right? Any level. She would say, Baldy, this is going on. So that's her nickname for me, right? And the thing is that just knee-jerk reaction evolved into adulthood, right? Where this brilliant young woman who is, you know, now graduated and pursuing med school and other things like that, but still anything that kind of comes up in her life that's irritating or struggling with for a second, she passes on to me. What we discovered over a glass of wine is she doesn't care about any of that stuff, right? It's 5 seconds. It's a knee-jerk reaction for her. I worry about it for 3 or 4 hours, like not again, fight or flight stuff, but it's in the back of my mind. And why do we do this? What do we do? And so one day we figured this out and I said, cut it out. You're killing me. and you know, I say that kind of tongue in cheek because she knows if there's ever anything serious, she comes to me and I'm there, right? In a heartbeat. But what she knew from that point on is I don't need to pass this on, right? Or create that. And so when we focus on these interactions, like you're saying, and you say, how do I just shift a couple of things? It opens up a sea of possibilities, both in removing the negative and actually leaning into the small moments better. that we see our top 10%ers tend to do. But we just don't tend to condition ourselves to look for it or take action on it as much as the relationships themselves. You know, when you pivot on that a little bit, it opens up a lot of possibility.
I think that's super interesting. I mean, when I go back to, you know, when I was growing up, right, and my dad worked at like Kodak, and they would have like physical note cards. In fact, I still think I have some of those around the place. And the note card would say something like, maybe just like it had a little checkbox on the top of the note card. It's like, maybe discarded, please file. It had like things you were supposed to do with this. And I was just thinking to myself, wow, life must have moved. And I'm sure they felt stressed out. And they felt, you know, they right. were But if you think about it, you had armies of secretaries who would do things like the filing or taking your phone right. calls. I mean, it just feels to me like life at work, at least,
I think it's so different.
At a more orderly, organized pace. Today, we've almost removed these interface layers kind of barriers to being instantly inundated with everything. Yeah. I just wonder. That seems to have just happened. Like, nobody's designed that. It's my.
Oh, I think the consultants have created it. I mean, you know, and I'm being tongue in cheek and probably irritated some consultants on the call, but you know, I mean, we've been through all these waves, these managerial fads, right? Of delayering, matrix based structures, agile work, talent marketplaces. You go through all these things that's taking the structure out of work, and pushing work and connectivity at you know, massive levels, right? And then you throw on that one firm cultures, globalization, other kind of softer initiatives, and then you throw on top of that, the array of technologies that have come in that all organizations are using, right? Slack channels, I'm not picking on Slack, but you know, there's all sorts of technologies, right? Usually we find these leaders are working across 6 to 9 applications to get their work done today. And it is a sea of interactions that are on people today. And there's positives for sure about that, right? From an innovation standpoint. But the problem is the analytics haven't kept up, right? So just like when we went in through a process revolution with Deming and Duran, it took 10 years for people to kind of see what to measure and how to look at worlds differently. And I think we're right at that in this game too, right? Because the people are burning out, like you said earlier, at mega proportions. And they're pointing at the work and saying the work has gone up, but it's not really the work. It's the way we're interacting around the work that's gone up so dramatically. And it's invisible, right? In most places, we don't have the analytics in place to be able to see it. And that makes it difficult, right? To get the structures. And like you're saying, to say, where is the equivalent of the administrative assistant that could be buffering or the filing systems or other things like that for us today?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think what's sort of running through my mind is the work of David Allen at MIT years ago. And he was interested in how scientists share information. And he came up with this thing that has subsequently been called the Allen curve, which is, if you think of the richness of information that gets shared, if you're all kind of working together and you're together every day, like my dad, right? He was a scientist and they all came to the lab every day, and that's what they did. And he found that there was this super rich sharing of information that share. And then the minute you moved more than 60 feet apart, so about 20 meters apart, the richness of information just catastrophically dropped. And I've often reflected on that work when I think about how we're working in these distributed, hybrid, you can call it what you will, environments, that we're all in that drop-off, right? So the richness of information that you would share if you were physically in the same room with people just isn't there. And so we're having to come up with all these sort of Band-Aid and duct tape solutions for recreating the richness of information flows when we can't rely on being physically present with people. And I think that's part of what goes into this history, right?
Yeah. I mean, we've seen, and Karen and I joke about this a lot, but through the pandemic, people pre-pandemic would complain about 8 1-hour days, right, of meetings. They couldn't get anything done. I'm so busy. And then somebody, because of these workarounds, we like, garbage can metaphor, we see the world through the tools we have. And we've moved to, well, instead of 8 1-hour meetings, let's do 16, 30-minute meetings. Let's make them shorter and more intense on us. And now people are twice as exhausted, right, coming through that, because you're more intense in those moments. You're switching across them, which creates a cognitive cost that's more than we realize. And we end the day with a to-do list based on 16 meetings, not 8, you know, and I'm obviously exaggerating a little bit, but the effect is real. Like, we know people are working 5 to 8 hours more a week, earlier into the morning, deeper into the night. And it's a product of trying to kind of, you know, reintroduce the interactions in that form, right? Using meetings or whatever the device is, versus thinking about what's the actual interaction that we want to have happen, right? How do we stimulate that in different ways?
Yeah. Our friend Juan Miguel is hungry for an example of perhaps something that you've tried or that you've seen a client try. Sort of identification, diagnosis, intervention, and then how did it kind of unfold?
Do you want to jump on that, Karen, or you want me
Sure. I'll talk about one that we talked about, that you mentioned, the kind of number of ways that we collaborate, the number of tools, Slack, text, email, whiteboards that we share, things like that. A simple example, which I think is a really great one, is a team that got together, realized we're killing each other with all these ways of trying to collaborate that, you know, all of us can relate to, the big chain email that has reply to all and everyone feels some obligation to say, thanks, sounds good, keep me posted.
Congratulations.
And then you forget.
Exactly.
All well intended. But then you literally lose the thread, or you introduce a new topic. So this team got together and took in a half hour meeting. They actually wrote up on a whiteboard all of the means of collaboration, all the tools that we use. And then they had three columns on the side: practices we want to keep, practices we want to discontinue, and then the specifics of what we do. And so, for example, just getting in that room together and figuring out, you know what, email should be bullet points only. No need to reply to all unless you're adding something that people need to know in the conversation. It will be assumed that you understand. Let's not communicate after, you know, 10 p.m. or 8 p.m. at night or nothing on the weekends. If you feel that you need to communicate something, just time it so it goes out at 8 a.m. the next day. They sound silly, but actually kind of giving people permission. It's, as Rob said, it's not the specifics of how we collaborate. It's the culture of how we collaborate in these ways. Getting people on the same page, save them. I can't remember the specific, Rob. Was it 16 to 18% of their time?
Yeah,
sort of added
yeah.
up to a big chunk of the week that they could just reduce from in that simple way, communicating and collaborating in ways that they all agreed were the norms. And so that's just one really good example, specifically a very easy practice you can do. It will be a relief to a lot of people, I think, to say, yeah, our protocol is going to be no emails after 8. You know, you can check it first thing and don't respond unless you're adding something to the conversation. We're just going to assume you read these things. You know, that's it. That's one really simple practice that I think is a great example.
I love that one. I love that one. One that I use a lot with teams is I'll have each member of the team say, like, to about every other member of the team, so sort of collected anonymously, person X should do 1 hour more of this per week and 1 hour less of that per week. So the idea is you're not changing your work life, right?
Yeah.
But what you are doing is reallocating an hour a week, and any of us could do that. And I think it's very consistent with the sort of interventions you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, as we look at it, so one of the things that we see, and Karen mentioned this, is the maintaining dimensionality in your life is really critical. The people that lose that and it just becomes about their profession and direct family, many, many times those stories didn't end well because everything, you know, kind of rises and falls on success there. But what we found is that people weren't doing massive things. It was really living the small moments more authentically with others that was the key for our 10 percenters. And so, you know, it wouldn't be necessarily hiking the Himalayas. They may do that, but that wasn't the real thing that was having the impact on the happiness. It was pivoting what they were doing in ways that pulled them into authentic connections with others. So I'll give you an example of one of our favorites was a very type A, you know, Silicon Valley executive. She'd gone through, I think it was Stanford, and been a runner, you know, all her life. And she came out and then continued to run. And she kind of set benchmarks for herself every year when we were speaking with her in kind of mid-40s, probably, that, you know, if I didn't get a personal best time in a year, that was a bad year for running, right? And eventually that's a losing strategy, right? As you progress. But she kind of woke up one day and said, that's somebody else's idea of fun, right? That's society's definition of why you run. What I really want to be doing is running with my child, her best friend, and a parent. And it evolved into a group, you know, in the community that ran together. And so what she was doing, and the principle of this that I would really highlight for people, and to your point, it wasn't one massive thing, right? It was taking something I'm already doing and saying, how do I pivot it just slightly that's going to pull me into these interactions that I value, right? That create a different life for me. And in that case, happened to be her family and community. But we see the same exact thing on the work side, right? There's tremendous latitude to go into projects and focus on how, if I made one or two pivots, could actually create and use work in a way that fulfills me, right? Rather than drains me in different ways. So that was kind of the hope of this, right? Is that burnout is an all-time proportion, but at the same time, we have never had more ability to shape what we do and who we do it with than today. And we just have to stop giving that up, you know, and focus on what's tractable in there.
I love that. So one question from one of our listeners is, tell us a little bit more about the 10%. Like what's the magic that they're doing that the rest of us are sort of flailing around looking for?
Do you want to go, Karen?
No, sure. No, I'll start and then you can
tell me.
In.
Yeah.
Okay. So again, we're starting with this group that we expected to be better than the rest of us at most things, right? They were identified by their own organizations as being high performers. So we knew, and they were very successful by all conventional measures. So we expected to kind of learn from all of them these things that they were just better at and how they used relationships. But as Rob said, it was so surprising to find, you know, into the interviews that the vast majority of them were really not doing that well. They were sort of, the veneer was there, but they were hanging on by a thread. So the 10%ers really stood out to us because these people were just better than the rest of us at navigating microstress. It's not that they had less than the rest of us. They were both better at being able to advocate for themselves and push back on change a few of those interactions. And again, they were mindful of what they were causing others, for sure. But this extra dimension of just choosing to build and lead a multidimensional life played a really important role. We were talking about resilience just a few minutes ago. And what, for example, the 10%ers instinctively do that some of us might not is, we might all think that resilience is something that we need to be stronger. We need to make ourselves stronger to deal with more and more stress, right? So a lot of the good things that people choose to do to deal with stress, yoga, mindfulness, meditation, things like that, those are all about making us stronger to take more, you know, finding some kind of inner grit so that the more stress that's heaped on our life, we can survive. The 10%ers were better at actually cultivating and using and tapping into a diverse network of people to help them be resilient when they needed to. There's a great story in the book of an anesthesiologist who had to keep his team coming into work during the beginning of the pandemic when it was really terrifying. You know, they didn't know, we didn't know whether they would be killed by going into work and being in a surgical room, but they had to do it. And what he talked about that helped him be resilient during that time was not that he had some kind of inner grit to do it. He obviously did. But the ways in which he was able to tap into people in his network in small ways that helped remove some of the microstress so that he could be strong enough to deal with that really stressful time when he literally said, we didn't know if we were putting ourselves on death's doorstep. And so it was small things like having a former boss who was a really good sounding board for him as he was trying to problem solve, or just being able to unwind a little bit from the stresses of the day that only she could understand. Having a colleague in another department who lent him resources, another administrative person, I'll take this off of your plate. We'll get the paperwork taken care of on this thing or that thing. Having people that he could turn to for small pieces of support that helped him build resilience in that time was really important. And that's probably the difference. That's what he talked about. So we all admired him for what he had to do, but the thing that made the difference for him were the way those connections played a role. So they're better at cultivating connections in ways that support them both in their resilience and their physical well-being. And as Rob mentioned earlier, just finding purpose in small moments. So they saw their life in multi-dimensions. They saw the importance of being not allowing their life to be narrower and narrower as they got older, you know, if they reached successive generation. A decade. And I think they made time for it, even in small ways. So being part of authentic connections with other people played a really important role in their ability to navigate and survive the flood of microstress we all have.
Yeah, and I guess to me, one of the things that really struck me about the sort of solution was not some whiz bang technology or some radically different way of working. It was this creation of authentic connections. And you really lean into that a lot toward the end of the book. And I'd love you to give some more examples. I remember one about a woman who had a book club or something that she'd given up on because she was so busy. And then picked it up, you know, later on.
Yeah. I mean, that's the interesting thing. Like we're stressed out and burned out. And my belief, you know, is that a significant component of that rise in stress is the way things are coming at us through connections today. Right. So it's not a disassociated stress. There's definitely that going on. There's the war, there's the economy, social justice, things like that. But the stress that's created through these small moments and interaction with others they're bigger, right? Because if I'm irritated with you and it comes my way that you've shifted my priority again, I'm more stressed, right? I'm more impacted by that. If I happen to love, you know, my child, Rachel, right? And I get hit with this thing. It's a bigger impact, right? Than seeing somebody that I don't know at the end of the day. And so we've created these conditions where, you know, all the ways that people are getting at us collectively in our lives can deliver these small doses of stress, right? In different ways and in a very fractured way more than ever before that has impact. But what the pandemic then has also done is it's stripped away our coping mechanisms, right? The social distancing that got introduced there took people out of the book clubs, out of their tennis groups, out of the bowling communities, whatever it was, right? Church, choir, religion, poetry, you name it, right? That's what people would talk about. And many people haven't gotten back in, right? And so what we know is those connections really matter. And you started with an example of Weight Watchers, I think it was. So I'll tell you one story from that one example. It was a life science executive in London. And, we happened to be actually the very first interview that we did. And I was gearing very heavily on the way connections have positive impact on well-being. And we focused on physical health, purpose, growth, and resilience, right? And first question to her was, well, tell me about a time in your life that you were becoming more physically healthy, and not what you did, but what the connections around you, you know, made possible for you, right? And made you to persist in that. And so she chuckled and then told a, you know, amazing story, lovely British accent. I won't try to emulate here, but it was about, she said, I was a couch potato, right? For 20 years, I was the person that dodged a gym in high school. I wanted nothing to do with physical activity. And then kind of late 30s, my doctor said, you need to do something about this. And her solution was she started walking around a park outside her flat in London. And then she bumped into people that were walking at the same time, so they would do it together. And then that moved to a charity walk and then a charity run. And you flash forward 10 years to when we were speaking with her. And she was somebody that was going on vacations with her spouse where they would run a marathon first, right? So this kind of, you know, self-prescribed couch potato, you know, never interested in physical activity, had developed a whole dimension in her life, right? As a product of running in this case. It could have been any number of things, but it happened to be running. That identity as a runner helped her push back on work and the stress of it, helped her experience the stress of work differently. But then what she said, and this is, I think, really important, and it's different than Weight Watchers, is it wasn't just the removal of a negative, right? That's what Weight Watchers, Alcoholics Anonymous, all these other social groups do, is they keep you accountable, they remove a negative. What she was also describing is that she literally was becoming somebody different with that group of people. Like, she saw them at their worst. They saw her at her worst. You know, they were coming at life from all different perspectives, not just life science executives. They were true friends. So there was an innate pull, a positive pull in this, not just a removing of a negative, but a positive pull that kept her on that positive trajectory on the health front. And that's kind of what we would see. You know, we know New Year's Eve resolutions, right? January 23rd, they're done for most people. What we found is people that embedded those health-oriented decisions into groups in that way. And it could be exercise, it could be nutrition, it could be any number of things. But those were the things that tended to persist for people and kind of shape their lives in different ways.
And Frank's asking, so if you think about multidimensionality, right? That it's that, right? It's not just I live, breathe, eat, and sleep, work. It's I've got other things I care about and other things that
right. Right. And you had said this earlier about we're in this flux of what is work, where is work? And that's what, you know, a piece of this is about, right? Early in the pandemic, I was asked by, I think it was Gartner, I can't remember, to influence some of their survey questions. And I'll never forget, you know, they let me include a bunch of items around how are you connecting with people and that sort of thing. That's my specialty. But they let me include one open-ended question around how are you experiencing the pandemic, right? And I think this was 8 weeks in when we thought that was a long time, right?
You know, it's all going to be done by Easter.
Right.
It's going to be done by 4th of July. Then it's going to be done by Thanksgiving.
Real drag, yeah.
But what was amazing to me, you know, normally you include open-ended questions and you know this, you get nothing back. You may get a page if you survey 100,000 people, nobody takes the time to fill that out. But this time there were hundreds of pages, you know, of responses back, and they took two incredibly different forms, right? The first was, this is absolutely amazing, right? I've gotten 2.5 hours of my life back because I'm not commuting. I'm talking to my significant other. My kids like me. I'm eating better. I'm healthier. You know, this has been a godsend to my life. It's helped me reshape, you know, what's going on, what's important. And you think, oh, that's a good thing. But then you get to the very next one and it's, oh my gosh, where did my commute go? That was the only time I had to think, this is killing me. I've got to get back in the office. and you know, and it would be almost 50-50. Right in there. And there's legitimate reasons for it. But a huge piece of it that I think is really important is for that second group of people, it wasn't the commute, it's that they gave up control of the time, right? They let other people's expectations become their idea of fun. And they pivoted, right, to, as Karen was saying, a smaller version of themselves, a more contained version. And so I think, you know, this idea of dimensionality and how do you preserve it is as important as where do you work and what is work. For people today, because the structures that we've relied on in the past, the commutes, the other things have kind of gone away in different ways.
Rita, can I just add one thing to the dimensionality comment? Because I think it's important. We used an example of a woman who became a marathoner, and that became a really important part of her identity. But the dimensionality can be found in small moments, too. One of the 10%ers had a really good phrase, and I just think it's been so useful. I've been thinking about it myself, that he works hard at respectful no's. So he has the time for enthusiastic, spontaneous yeses, meaning he works hard to make sure his schedule is not so overwhelmed with things, reacting to things, filled with things, that he can be available to be, you know, in his yard on the weekends and chat to his neighbors. He was giving us an example of a neighbor came and knocked on his door on a Saturday because his basement was flooded and he was able to make time. I can go help you for an hour. He just wanted to be that person who was connected to other people. It doesn't have to be it can be in giant activities that you choose to do because they're really inspiring to you and really engaging and you're connected with other people. It can be in the small moments too. And I think that's a powerful thing to realize. You don't have to set your goals up here. Your goals can be worked into the everyday in a way that actually will make, again, a material difference in how you feel.
Yeah, and I like that deliberate decision to not engage in stuff. There's a practice I use, which is called cancel elation, which is, you know, imagine somebody asked you to do something and it's like 3 months from now. And we all do this, right? We have this idea, oh, 3 months from now.
It'll be so much better then.
And then you imagine it happening like tomorrow, but you got the news that it was going to be canceled. And if that prompts a feeling of elation, say no.
That's a great rule of thumb.
I will be using that. Yeah.
And I found that to be super helpful because, like you, you know, I'm always inclined to say yes. And I think the older you get and the better known you are, the more people want stuff from you. And it really is hard sometimes to say, you know, I just can't do everything everybody asks me. And to sort of acknowledge that, I think is very important.
Right. That'll be something I have in my quiver now.
Cancellation. I also, I'll add a personal tip for me. I have a rule, which I've come to learning the hard way over the years, of sleeping on things before I say yes for 24 hours. Because I am an idea enthusiast and I like to say yes to everything. And I say yes right away because in that moment, I really want to. But sometimes when I wake up the next morning, I have maybe cancellation and I realize that that's maybe not the best use of my time. I think it's a really handy rule of thumb to sort of offer other people is just sleep on it. If you still want to do it in the morning and it makes sense to you and you haven't had all those doubts of realizing of the consequences and the collaborative footprint, as Rob talks about it, you know, it may buy you some time back.
Well, I think that's also super interesting. And when you think about the micro stress we create for other people, and I'll just use, you know, speaking as a case in point, right? And I'm sure you get these too. So people will write and say, I want you to talk to my book club, college class, professional association, whatever it is. Oh, and it's only half an hour or it's only an hour, right? And what they're looking at is that sort of unit of definite programmed, canceled, you know, in the book kind of time. What they're not looking at is, well, wait a minute, there's logistics around that. If it's a thing, I have to travel there. I have to sort of put it in my to-do list. Somehow I've got to prepare for this. Right. You know, it's never just an hour, never.
Right. And you feel bad saying no, because it looks small in that moment, but you add on to that, okay, you've got to do a tech check ahead of time and you've got to meet with suddenly two other senior people that inserted themselves in the conversation. You know what I mean? And it's all the collaborations that are, again, kind of invisible that you add up. One of the great interviews was from one of the tech companies.
And this person really poignantly had started to put a collaborative cost to standard asks, you know what I mean? And to say, okay, I know when I get this, you know, it looks like 1 hour, but it's really five. And here, let me show you. And it was all the meetings, right? And everything else that inevitably kind of boiled up. But I think we could use more of that, you know, and to your point, I do that too often. Oh yeah, I'll jam 30 minutes in and then I'm exhausted because I backed them up or whatever, you know, that way. So it's a challenge.
It's not a bad thing, right? I mean, it's a good thing, right? If people are interested in engaging and they want to be supportive. And I really do, I mean, personally, and I know you do too, I really try to be helpful, you know, to people as much as you can, but there's only so many hours in the day. And if being helpful at a sort of a low level of benefit, it means you're not being helpful at high impact of benefit, then that really it's not actually helpful, right? It seems like
That was one of the things our 10 percenters did really well. You made me reflect a little bit on that too, is they were much clearer on the values they wanted to be experiencing in their lives or the capabilities they wanted to be using. They wouldn't say it that way, you know, but they would come back and say, if you ask somebody, a high performer, these are all high performers. I really want to emphasize that. These are all people that are conventionally successful from a performance standpoint. It just happened to be that some also managed to thrive too in a different way. But you would ask the conventional person, what do you want to be doing in 3 to 5 years? And they would say, oh, I want this role, or I want this kind of promotion or things like that. The more successful person, they would have much greater granularity on what they wanted to be doing in terms of skills, expertise they wanted to be using in their work, values they want to experience, like mentoring, you know, maybe creativity, whatever it was. And that has a lot to do with what you're saying now. Like, you figure out what's my true unique value add in the situation, and then reflect on, okay, and these other asks, you know, what's not good for me, you know what I mean? What, or the company in some ways, and could other people be doing it? And so we would see a lot of really cool devices. People would reflect on that. The really good examples, they would actually reflect with their partner, you know, on a monthly date night or quarterly. You know, some of them had report cards they gave each other. There's some really cute things that kind of created accountability for it. But that was neat, because half these decisions, we never make them in isolation, right? You're always making them in tandem with somebody that you're interdependent with too. And so kind of seeing it that way is helpful.
Yeah. Oh, I really think so. So one of the most interesting to me sort of diagnoses that you did is this category of identity challenges, when you're being challenged with respect to, you know, your values or your purpose in life or who you think you are. And to me, it kind of connects to this whole conversation that's happening about diversity, inclusiveness, sense of belonging. And it just struck me that, like, I'll just list the ones that were there. So values conflict, interactions that undermine our own confidence, draining interactions with family or friends, and disruptions to your network. I thought all of those were really interesting, because they kind of get at this, like, what is it about us that makes us different from, you know, the next person or the person over there? Or how do we think about what our purpose and values are? And I just thought it was very interesting that you actually flagged that up as a whole category of micro stresses, which I had not thought about before reading your book.
Yeah, they were, and I can give you an example of one, and I'm sure Karen can too, but they were, that to me was one of the more interesting points of this. So as the categories go down, this drain capacity, that's kind of obvious. You go, oh, this is killing me. It's the emotional impact. And that actually is a little bit more subtle and has greater effect on us. And then the value pieces, those are the ones that sneak up on you, right? In 2, 3, 5 years, and you wake up and go, oh my gosh, you know, I've become somebody I didn't mean to be when I started this all out. I've been chasing a system of behavior. And so, you know, one of those, the shifts to your network as an example, is a lot of our identity is not just ours, right? It's reinforced by the groups we're a part of, right? Whether it's religious affiliations, community service, philanthropic, artistic endeavors, things like that. And what would happen a lot of times with people is they would take what looked like a conventionally good idea, a role in another city that offered them $500,000 more, right, or whatever, or a promotion, right? And what to us was fascinating is, you know, the large proportion of the people, when they talked about these transitions in their lives, they would get the promotion or whatever and go home and say, okay, you're not going to see me for 12 months, right? Things are going to be busy for 12 months. And that just seemed to be okay. you know, okay, fine. But what happened is those people would then take themselves out of those things that kept them whole as humans to begin with. And especially if they were skill related, like singing or some sort of tennis group or whatever it may be, they tended not to get back into it. They would think they would, but they tended not to get back in. And so that's what Karen was referencing earlier, is just we would successively see these people become smaller versions of themselves through a series of those moves. Whereas our 10 percenters did it differently. They would come into the situation and say, how do I become a bigger version of myself, and actually create what might seem overwhelming, but that actually kept work in perspective, you know, and actually kept, because we all know this, right? Work can fill the time we give it. Sure. And they kind of, you know, kept it in perspective. So that one idea, there are shifts in the networks. It may not seem like a big deal, but it is when you look at it that way, right? Mm-hmm. That it's the interactions, the groups you're a part of that has a lot to do with how we feel we are showing up as humans.
We're not happy. When it comes back, Karen, to me, to place, the way he opens, how will you measure your life? By right. talking about his Harvard reunion, you know, and goes back after 25 years, right? And there are people who are estranged from their children, they're divorced, they're overweight, their health is, you know, shot. And he said, nobody intended for that to happen.
It's exactly true. Even as Rob was talking about the sort of things that remove you from the networks that are important to your sense of self-identity, what happens is these things all happen in small steps. It's not like I go from 0 to 60, I'm a totally different person. It's just that step by step, choice by choice, you just find yourself kind of being a little more uncomfortable with the decisions you're making, the choices, the way you're responding to things. You're in reactive posture all the time rather than proactive posture. And so the problem is it creeps up on you. You know, it's the frog in the boiling water. It's, you know, you don't notice what's different, what's making you feel uncomfortable until the water gets pretty hot, and then suddenly you're in a really different place. So I think that's one of the important insights from our research, is that it's not any giant shift that you make. It's not any one thing. It is the hundreds of little things that can actually start to make you feel just not being the you want to be. And a lot of people in the research sort of would talk about the one step too many. They had just taken steps because they, not because they were trying to keep up with the Joneses, but because they had a self-identity as a provider in some way, or wanting the best for their family. It was kind of how they saw themselves in the relationships that mattered to them. But somehow one step too many was the one that became the killer one. They moved a little too far away from their workplace and the commute suddenly just became grueling, or they moved up, you know, to get to a private school or a school system that just meant they were never able to see their kids because they were working too hard to keep up to that. It's the step-by-step that leads you to a place where it challenges your sense of identity. And again, in the interactions, you can shift it from the negative interactions to better ones, more positive ones.
I love that. And so, you know, it doesn't just, as you don't have to make a great big giant decision to find yourself in this mess, you also can kind of work your way out of it. And you talk specifically about purpose, connections, and forming relationships with others as characteristic of what your 10 percenters were able to do.
I think what's really important about the 10 percenters and purpose is I'll just say that they find purpose in small moments. They don't have to see themselves. Purpose doesn't have to come from, I'm going to cure cancer. I'm going to create a whole mentoring program for my whole town to help, you know, kids who come from less privileged backgrounds. They can find purpose in everyday connections in small ways. And that's a really important insight to me, because so many of us might think we can never attain that sense of purpose that we're supposed to have. So with us, we're failing in some way. If you see purpose as being part of your everyday life in small moments, I think that completely changes your perspective. And purpose is really powerful in terms of long-term happiness, in terms of our physical health, in terms of our overall well-being. Having a sense of purpose really tracks to just being better overall.
Interesting. Really super interesting. So have there been any surprises? I mean, the book hasn't been out that long, but have there been any surprises as you've sort of virtually or in person traveled around the world talking about
this? Yeah, I've never so, you know, I've been at this for a while doing different things with the ideas, and I've never seen the reaction that I have. So I had the privilege of the launch day. I was at Crotonville with a, you know, huge number of leaders there, kind of talking through the ideas. And I could go down a whole list of companies actually that have brought these ideas into their top leadership programs. And I just haven't seen the same kind of, you know, wow, like this is actually not only is it going on, but this is actually an approach that helps us get down to a set of finite things I can do about it. And that's one of the problems. Too many times we as authors come back in and say, here's the one principle. And we're pushed by all the publishers too.
Oh, sure.
Just one
thing. Tell me the one thing.
Right, right. And you could do that. Statistically, we could say, here's the, you know, the most impactful thing. But what people really need are devices that help them get down to the two or three that are crushing down, right? And evolving that list down to the two or three that really matter. And then say, okay, here's what I could go do. And that's the effect for why we do things like that app, as an example, right? It's a tool that allows, in ways the text doesn't do as great a job on, to get down to the two or three things that are conventionally important to you. So I think if I had a surprise in it, it's just the, and I experienced this going through the interviews too, you know, Karen alluded to it as well, but these are all successful people. So, you know, the first 10 minutes of every interview is rainbows and lollipops, right? Everything is great. And then you get deeper and deeper into their kitchens and it's like, wow, people are struggling. Like, and that's what I meant when I said it got into our souls, is you just kind of, you know, really feel that. And so I think, you know, the surprise there was how bad it was for everybody, you know? And I think the surprise going through the book, at least for me, is just the thirst for it. You know, what I'm seeing is impact there, for me anyway.
Yeah, I totally get that. And the other thing that I think is fascinating is it also fits into, at least for Western leaders, you know, this trope about how, well, if I'm really busy, I must be really valuable, right? I must be really important. I must be a really big deal. Right. I'm just flat out busy 24/7 and everybody wants my time and attention. And I think we perhaps unwittingly allow ourselves to get sucked into that. Right. And,
right.
And, you know, the fact that I may have a free afternoon, why, you know, for a lot of us, that's like, right. Creepy. You talk about one of the guys in the book who's his flight got canceled or something.
Yeah. I mean, he sat in the garage for 2 hours. I think, well, I can't remember the exact time, but he's like, how did this happen? How did I get here? I don't have hobbies. I don't have friends. Kids aren't talking to me. My wife's off doing her thing.
Right.
And exactly. That's when we say these echo chamber moments. And I think it's to your point, it's like the busyness. And I think the other thing is, you know, for successful people, each of these micro stresses, they're not a big deal, right? You just get over it. But if you start looking at it and saying, well, maybe if I shifted a couple, you know what I mean? Rather than plowing through, better things could happen. I think that's the mindset we want to take a little bit, you know, into this for people.
I love that. I really love that. So how do people, well, obviously they can download the app. The app is the Micro Stress Effect, and it looks like the book. And I love the sort of symbolism of the book, all these little, you know, pins of stuff that you've got to be dealing with, that that, you know, each one individually is no big deal, right? Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think it's almost like I know myself, I would feel really weird like complaining about some of these things. It's like,
right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I got my 15th email from a coworker about this thing, right? And it's really important and we both want it to go well. But I just, like, I see that person's name in my inbox and it's just like, ugh. You know, what stupid thing do I have to spend 20 minutes now unraveling?
Right, right? Right.
And it sort of feels, I don't know, beneath you to even remark upon it as an issue. But if enough of those 20 minute issues come up in a day, it's not a great day.
Right, right. And again, that impact, right? 3 to 5 times. From the negative than the positive. And so it is worth, you know, just introducing a little structure into that and saying, okay, let's, you know, secure a time, a 30-minute block, right? And let's have this all done there versus in streams. And there's different ways to, you know, to say that, but it is, I totally emails. Agree with you. Yeah.
I mean, rather than sending 15 emails, maybe we have a 15-minute conversation.
Right.
I remember those. You know, do you remember like telephones? Like you,
it, yeah, no, yeah. No memory.
One on the wall.
I do.
Dialed,
I do.
Right.
The rotary. Yeah.
I was in a restaurant in Brooklyn recently because I needed a passport like to get to the cool part of Brooklyn, but my daughter and her friends, and they had a payphone on the wall, and above the payphone was this sign, a historical communication device.
Oh, that's funny.
Is really
that
funny. Is funny.
That makes me feel old now. Yeah.
But so how do people learn more? So let's say people have heard this, they said, oh wow, you know, yeah, I'm there, I could use a dose of getting rid of this stuff. What are some
Yeah, so obviously the app, I would take that up, you know, take us up on it. It's free for everybody to download, very easy resource. The book is obviously out on Amazon and other sellers. And we, of course, appreciate, you know, purchases of the book. We also have set up a website, one that's housed on my site. It's robcross.org, but there's pages that include information on the book and then a bunch of videos and other resources that that people can use. And then Karen has her site too as well. Karen, I'll let you, I can't remember the name of it.
No, so. That's great. No, my site's karendillon.net. It's very simple. Yeah. But Rob's the robcross.org microstress page is actually really helpful. It's lots of resources, lots of extra bits for understanding this. And I think the app personally is fantastic. It's a really good way to do a kind of self-assessment on the, you know, top five microstresses that you probably need to cope with or deal with or try to correct in some way. And then it gives you reminders and tools. I think I really do recommend the app. I think it's a great start.
That's fabulous. Well, I can't thank you enough for joining me. I know making the time for an hour-long conversation is not easy. Once again, just to reinforce, called The Microstress Effect, great book. Very easy read, very practical. And in the course of the book, it really, each microstress has its own kind of little pointers about how you might deal with them. And it's just very, very practical. So thank you for writing it. Thank you for being here. And to be continued, I hope.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Always, Rita. Always a pleasure.